This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and we have two of my favorite guests, Charles Todd in the form of Charles and Carolyn Todd, who have written the fifth Bess Crawford mystery, A Question of Honor, and they're here to talk about it. Hello, guys.
Hello. Good morning. How are you today?
Right now, everybody knows that you're mother and son, so there's no mystery there anymore.
No, not anymore.
It's kind of hard to believe that we've got 5 in that series and a total of over 20 books. Sometimes it's hard to keep a tally of them.
You guys must be exhausted by now, all this writing.
Well, it's funny. Once you get into a Rutledge or a Bess, you start getting excited again, and you can't wait to see how it ends. So it gives you the thrill of a new project, the thrill of a new mystery, the thrill of a new puzzle, and it just carries you right along.
It certainly does.
It's a good thing.
I like this cover. I like the Question of Honor cover. I mean, some of them I can just stare at for hours. I don't know why. And I mean, I just love looking at the covers.
It is a beautiful one.
Yeah.
They really, really went all out for that one, and we were very pleased. The book underneath is a lovely green that fits with the jacket.
Wow. Oh, yeah, you're right, it does.
Yes, it's just wonderful to see that.
Do you guys get to design these books? I mean, do you have any say in the design?
We have been fortunate to have a very, very good art department working with us everywhere we've been. But HarperCollins does now actually give us an opportunity to take a look at a couple suggestions and make some comments. Obviously, the marketing people and others have a lot of say-so as well, but it's nice to participate in the process.
This is the first time we've talked about the Bess Crawford mystery. Usually we talk about your other ones.
Oh, yes,
your Rutledge
right.
ones. But this is the first time.
Where have you been, David?
That's right. So tell my audience why you started writing the Bess Crawford ones. I mean, you were already doing the Rutledge ones, and I'm sure that was a lot of work. But now
we're sitting around bored.
Is that what it was?
No.
Out of sheer boredom?
We had been talking about the woman's side of the war ever since we finished the Murder Stone, which was a standalone. It did lend itself to a series. And the more we thought about it, the more we liked several of the concepts we'd come up with. So one day we were in New York talking to our editor, and we mentioned that we might like to do a woman's series to run concurrently with Rutledge. And she said, oh, when can I have the first book?
Oh, my gosh. Just like that.
We haven't even written it yet.
We'll just go home and write it right now and bring it back.
Yeah, no problem.
And so she was really enthusiastic. Tavia and Danielle and others in the organization loved the book.
Isn't it great to be loved so much?
Well, we wanted a different sort. We were trying to express not only what was happening to young women during that time period, it was really a modernization of Britain was really starting to kick in, and also with she's the two parts. On the one part, she is her mother's family has an established reputation. Her father's a retired regimental colonel, so she has that depth of family history, as well as being someone who is quite strong in their own way from growing up in India. And we were able to take her back.
You know, we wanted someone who wasn't reared in the strict Victorian concept of women and their role.
Mm-hmm.
And so giving her a background in India and other places where her father had been posted, expanded her horizons. Like so many English women of the time, she was not satisfied with the very, very tightly controlled Victorian attitude. And this gave her a lot more leeway. She's not a sleuth who goes looking for murder. If you've noticed in the series, every situation she finds herself in has come to her in some fashion.
Right.
In the second book, for example, she had brought a young flyer back to England to have his burns attended to. And he was one of a convoy. She got him sent in Hampshire, but all through the time she had been treating him and working with him from France to Hampshire, he had been clutching the picture of his wife that he always carried with him.
Mm-hmm.
And when she leaves him in Hampshire and goes back to London, who should she see in the railway station but his wife? But the wife is bidding a very fond, tearful farewell to someone else. And this is how Bess gets tangled up into something that she feels obliged to explore.
I always feel like she's sort of like a Nancy Drew almost. I mean, she's always investigating things. I'm thinking of Nancy Drew as I'm reading these books.
She's got a curious nature about her and a strong sense of responsibility and duty. That's why she joined the nursing corps, because being the only female, the only child, and being female, as her father had done, was by going off to war as a nurse. And so, naturally, with her time around the military and everything else, she's a little bit more conversant about things and a little more knowledgeable when she's dealing up at the front or taking soldiers back to England.
She also has the nurse's sense of curiosity. A good nurse pays attention to her patient. She knows what the fever means, or the change in the way the patient looks or the way the patient behaves. She notices these things and she brings them to the attention of the doctor. And so this sharpened Bess's ability to see something and make a decision. A lot of nurses seem to love Bess because somehow or another we captured their approach to their careers.
Hmm.
It hasn't gotten me any extra chocolate ice cream, but every time I go to the hospital and run into one of the nurses who's read the Bess Crawford series, they're always having nice things to say about it. And I believe it's genuine, not, oh, gee, you're, you know, a patient, I'm going to say the nice things.
You guys are so well established. Do you ever worry about what people say about your books? I mean, does that bother you? It still bothers you after all this time?
Well, I'm not going to say bother. The feedback is very important to us,
right?
Because it's a two-stage process. We work and come up with the movie in our combined mind's eye, and we try to put that on paper and communicate it to other people. And so it's very important to us to listen to readers who fuss and don't, because it lets us know not only, oh yes, this was written right, it was properly explained, to more of, yes, the readers are getting the point we're trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the most part, we get glowing reviews. But I always remember the fact that it's the reader who has made us what we are. And so what the reader thinks and how they perceive the books really matters. You can't be a writer and just ignore the people who are out there buying your books.
Right.
Especially nowadays with Facebook and websites and all that, could communication sources that are now available.
Oh, did you see on our website that this last trip to England, we kept sending back snippets of what was going on, and they were posted to Facebook.
Oh, really? I'll have to check that out. No, I hadn't seen that.
We had pictures and some of the things. Sorry, allergies. We had pictures and some of the things that we had enjoyed and thought our readers might enjoy as well.
Now, between the two series, the Rutledge and the Vess Crawford, do you enjoy writing them equally as well?
Absolutely.
They're both enjoyable. There were two things. First of all, obviously, we've been writing Rutledge longer, but they're more family members, so to speak. Every time your contract's up for renewal, you just can't conceive what you'd do if, you know, there was no more Rutledge. But at the same time, it gives us different outlooks, and the fun thing is we may be doing this piece of research or going to this place to see certain things, and we may not find what we're looking for Rutledge, but we'll see something that's a little snippet here and there that we file away for the next best or the best after that. Or
right. You know. You're always finding
concurrently in your mind.
Right.
The main thing is that they are so different that you don't get them confused.
No, not at all.
Rutledge is the professional. Bess is the amateur. Rutledge is a member of Scotland Yard. Bess is a member of the Queen Alexandra's Nursing Service. You don't. In fact, one of the reasons we came up with Bess was that we had noticed in our file of what ifs that there were a lot of things that Rutledge couldn't, as a professional, explore. And we began to see that an amateur could do this very well with this project or that project. And that led us to thinking about Bess as a character.
Now, this book has a triple murder in it, which I found is fascinating. I mean, have you ever done a triple murder in any of your books before?
Actually, I think we came close in the Rutledge that was set near Hastings.
Yeah, and it also depends on how you define the triple murder, because sometimes the one with Madeira, the
proof of guilt.
Yeah.
As we delve back into the quote unquote family history, and Caroline went to Madeira actually.
Oh, cool.
For that, there's a lot of times multiple incidents of things that come up from the past. But to be quite honest with you, I hadn't really. I guess you could say that Wings of Fire had quite a few.
Yeah, it's been a number of years since I read that book. I know that's what got me started on you guys.
That was one of our favorites.
That was what told me that, boy, there's really something here. There's really a tremendous writer behind this. And that leads me to a question. If something, you're both very, very intelligent people. I talked to you over the years, and I realize this just by talking to you. But if something were to happen to either one of you, would one person be able to write these series?
I don't know. We haven't even considered that.
Oh. Yeah, I just
we ain't thunk about that one yet. What? Don't really want to.
No, absolutely not. It my curiosity got the best of me there. Sometimes I just get curious.
You know, and it's actually a fair question. It's just I don't know the answer personally.
Well, you're so used to working together. I mean, it's like it's like losing an arm if one of you were gone, you know.
Absolutely, and I feel like what Prince Charles said one time about an answer to a question of would he want to be king, and he said, well, he had been trained for that,
mm-hmm.
but he knows that when he's king, his mother is gone.
And
that's a very powerful thing, and it doesn't mm-hmm. have to be the mother, it could be the son. But that's a very powerful thing to consider.
Well, what you guys do for the readers is just astronomical. I mean, to write these books and have readers enjoy them as much as... I can't wait to read the next Rutledge book. I mean, I really, really look forward to it.
More than anything else, I think, and it's one of the concerns we had about Bess and why we waited so long, was we wanted to make sure that Rutledge was established, number one, and number two, that Bess was not going to cause us to reduce the quality of our manuscripts for Rutledge. We didn't want Rutledge to suffer as a result of Bess. And a long way around, that answers your question about what would we do continuing on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the predominant answer would be it's more what would, would I or would Caroline be able to continue to maintain the quality?
Absolutely, yeah.
Of the book. If it's not write one, then just, throw one together and say, here it is.
Now, here's the big question, though. Can Bess ever fall in love?
She's busy with the war right now.
Yeah.
And the nursing service frowns upon any connection with her patients.
Oh, that's too bad, because she's lonely.
Well, you never know.
You never know?
But she hasn't told us yet.
Do your readers say that to you? Do your readers worry about your characters, or do they say?
Oh, absolutely.
It's interesting, because, like Rutledge, is he ever going to find happiness? Is he ever going to get married? Is he ever going to get cured? My answer to the last one being, I hope not anytime soon.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
It's funny because a lot of people, we give a very slim description of Rutledge's physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting when we go to conferences and things where we're speaking before a panel, and that will come up, and 10 people in the audience will have totally different mental
wow.
pictures of what exactly Rutledge looks like, and it's more a battle between them than it is us.
Well, people had asked us when we first introduced Beth if she was going to marry Rutledge in the long run. And it had never occurred to us that she might be the perfect wife for Rutledge. There's just different people, different theories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Beth is really wise, young as she is and busy as she is, not to get involved. But then there's always Simon, and we don't know exactly what the relationship is with Simon, who is a close family friend.
He certainly gets frustrated with her. The frustration just builds over the course of the book, which I find fascinating.
He's trying to keep her safe for the sake of her parents.
I mean, what he really wants to say is, butt out, will you? Just get it.
No, I think what he's saying is, leave it to the men in your family.
Right.
And she's saying, I'm perfectly capable.
Yeah, she's that strong woman. She wants to do her own thing, and you can't blame her. I mean, she's just like women today. They want to be independent. They want to do everything themselves, and it's great. I mean, it's a great thing. But
there was a blog on Jungle Red Writers, which is a very interesting group, talking about this. We were part of that at the time, and they were discussing how many English women from about 1870 to 1920, 1930, who had done things that would have shocked Queen Victoria. I mean, there was a woman who had gone to medical school. There was Madame Curie. There was Beryl Markham, who flew the Atlantic. You know, there was
British women had the right to vote before they did in the United States.
Wow.
That's right. And and there were women who traveled the world. I mean, Freya Stark is a little later in the picture, but there was Florence Nightingale who was staunchly opposed to letting men die simply because there were no facilities to keep them alive when they were severely wounded. I mean, it just, you look at this, there is a strain in these English women. You look at Queen Elizabeth I, you look at Bess Hardwick, you look at so many of the others who kept the castle while the men were on crusade. There's a strong strain there. It's not, it's sometimes buried by the mores of the day, and then it pops up again and surprises you.
It's like Eleanor of Aquitaine. Yeah. You know, if she wasn't paying ransom on one of her kids, they were paying ransom on her.
And it's funny, while you're reading the books, you don't think of it. I mean, you think of modern-day women, how independent they are, but you forget how back then it wasn't as easy to be strong and independent.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons we chose this era was that it had so much to say to the modern period. And it has resonance politically, historically. It shows how women had to step up in the war and how hard it was for them to go back to being housewives and mothers once the war was over. Have you seen Bletchley Circle, the PBS show?
No, I haven't.
It's about women who had served at Bletchley in the code breaking. Uh-huh. And after the war, they became ordinary people by the terms of the Official Secrets Act. They couldn't tell people what they had done during the war. And yet they're drawn together when there is a series of murders, and they see a pattern that the police aren't seeing because they were trained to see patterns.
Interesting.
And, you know, this is another example of women who were able to do extraordinary things and who afterwards were relegated to the home and hearth. I mean, there's nothing wrong with home and hearth. I was a housewife, a mother.
Right.
But,
well, it's kind of like
alone.
Here in Wilmington, there is a National Guard Air National Guard base that used to be a Air Force base during World War II, where if a bomber primarily was damaged or whatever on a mission and needed to be sent back to the States for repairs, it was women pilots that flew these torn up pieces of junk all the way back across the Atlantic and ferrying them in from the Pacific, but here they were flying them in from the Atlantic.
And back again.
Getting them fixed and then turning around and flying them back because they didn't want to waste men pilots, A, taking them out of combat, and B, if the plane went down, losing a perfectly good bomber pilot.
And these women never got recognition for what they did.
No, most people don't even know that story.
Wow, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, should be known for your accomplishments.
We're not feminists in the sense of that, but we also are history buffs, and this is an aspect of history that really has to be remembered somehow.
I'm curious what you think about, they've just announced that somebody's going to continue with a new Hercule Poirot story. And I'm wondering if somebody, how you would feel if somebody tried to continue your series. I'm wondering what you feel about that.
We wouldn't allow it.
You would never allow it.
I haven't talked to John Curran about that. He's the person who knows what's going on in Matthew Pritchard's world of dealing with
John, for those who don't know, John Curran works for the Agatha Christie estate, and he was the the one that published the, they found in the attic her notes that she had taken for writing the different books.
Right,
and
yes.
John turned that into a book. He's done two books. First one was highly critically acclaimed.
Second one was fascinating. If you're interested in writing,
yeah,
read John Curran's Making of Murder. He captures what Agatha Christie was doing beautifully.
Man, who would dare to try to continue her cool Poirot?
Now
I think John could do it. John Curran. I don't know who the person is doing the.
Sophie Hannah is the one that's going to do it.
Who is?
Sophie Hannah is her name, and I just read one of her books recently. It was really tremendous, but I can't even imagine what it's going to be like with Hercule Poirot again. To get that down to with science, you know, to really feel like it's Hercule again, it's going to be very difficult.
Well, wasn't it the Bourne Legacy? I think it was series that the author died, obviously, and they hired someone to write the next one in the series. I think it was the Bourne
yes.
series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was.
They've been doing
not
that.
Not the movies, the book.
Right. They've been doing Robert Ludlum's books. But, you know, that's a daunting task. And quite frankly, I would not want to do that with another author, and yes, as long as Caroline and I are alive, that would not be happening.
I can't imagine anybody else doing it, or doing justice to it, even coming close to doing justice.
Well, and not to be rude, it goes back to what I said before about how Bess and Rutledge are like members of the family. We feel very strongly about those two characters, and obviously would not be very pleased if somebody decided to pick up the series, you know.
Well, let me give you a perfect example of a good job. I've always been a fan of Tony Hillerman.
Oh, yeah.
And I love his books. I met 2 years ago his daughter, Anne. And just recently, my editor, who was also her editor and was Tony's editor, let me know that she has written a new Navajo Police novel.
Wow.
It's called Spider Woman's Daughter. And my editor sent me a copy of it, but it's not out until October. She sent me a copy of it, and Anne takes up Bernie, the policewoman who is Jim Chee's wife.
Oh.
And I read it and I thought, this is phenomenal. She gives a little more description than Tony did about a couple of things, but they fit into what she's trying to tell the public. And the story just, you know, she did a superb job. But then she's her father's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She knew how he thought. She knew how he felt about these characters.
So who better to continue it?
Francis and Mary Higgins Clark's daughter has not really picked up the series. She has her own style, but it's sort of it has its similarities. And I don't really see a problem with that, and I guess if we're gone to the netherworld, whatever.
Exactly. Now, the Bess Crawford series, do you guys have ideas like 3-4 books down the line, or do you just take it one book at a time?
Both. We'll have some idea that we think. For example, at some point, I think we've decided that Bess is going to go after the war is over and she is free of the war. She's going to go to Ireland to a wedding. And I have a fairly good idea, and I think Charles does too, of how that's going to work. But that's going to be 2-3, I don't know how many books ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying before with research. You may be over here doing research on a Rutledge or over here doing this best, but you see something and you set it aside, And then a couple of books later, I remember we were doing some work on some Rutledge books, and we went through a town and said, no, we're not going to use it, but we did turn around and we used it in the Murder Stone. You know, it just went into that file of just ideas and
let's use it for something, but we just don't know what yet.
Yeah, you know, and that's why I have so many gadgets.
We really, right now, we have two superb ideas for the next Rutledge, and it's going to be which one, toss a coin to see which one is going to be the next one. Both are going to be exciting to work with. I mean, I think this is the one thing about writing that is so extraordinary and so unexpected. You get this instant burst of knowledge. You see something and you say to yourself, oh, and I know how this goes, and wouldn't that work in with this? And oh, don't you see how this goes together? And it's a marvelous thing. And yet, when we talk to our editor about the proposal for the next book, she gets two paragraphs because we don't really know what's going to happen until we start the writing.
I have always said our greatest work of fiction has been our proposals for editors.
Do you guys have trouble with the endings of your books? I mean, it's so difficult.
Oh, no, they come out of the story.
Really? You never have trouble at all?
We've talked before about letting the characters drive the story.
Yeah,
and so naturally, it tends to draw itself to a natural conclusion. I think the part where you start to sweat things a little bit is as you're approaching that end, it's trying to, have I got it? Wait a minute.
Right.
You know, it's there, and you're following the roadmap, but you start reading directions and looking at your tom-tom a little bit.
Right.
One of the things, let me give you an example. In the very first Rutledge, A Test of Will, we were 20 pages from the end and still weren't sure who the murderer was. And then all of a sudden, Rutledge made a comment out of the blue. And we thought, oh my God, yes, he's right. And he looks into what he has, I don't want to give anything away, but he looks into what he has remembered, and it just all of a sudden opens the door, and he sees...
Yeah, boom, there it was.
But does that happen every time you write a book?
Before we got up to the last 20 pages, you know, you're starting to think, wait a minute.
But the question is, does that happen with every book? Does that happen a lot?
It comes out of the story.
Because I guess what I'm trying to explain is there's a certain amount of thrill as you get towards the end of the book, and I hope that's something we communicate. I've always said our best compliment is when people write and say, I hate you, I was up till 2 in the morning finishing your book,
Absolutely.
And I had an 8 o'clock meeting. Then we know that we've captured that sense of suspense and drama that we're trying to reach in the final crescendo of the book.
We just heard from a very dear friend in Little Rock, Sharon, who said that as she had gotten the new Bess and stayed up all night, she couldn't stop reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are trying to convey, this sense of pace, this sense of suspense, the sense of the puzzle out there that has to be solved, the idea that we're with you as you read it and we're coming along at the same time looking at all the clues and looking at all the characters and finding the end as it evolves. I've never been a fan of, oh, well, he was mad and so he did it.
Right.
That's a cop-out in many ways, because what you're saying is, I don't know how to end it.
I think you have an obligation to the reader that once you get to the end, even if they didn't see it coming, that once they reach the end, it does make sense, or they can feel like I've just spent 405 pages for you to tell me the butler did it.
Right, or to set, or to introduce a character at the very end that you haven't seen in the book, you feel cheated. I mean, some writers will do that.
That's dumb.
I mean, that does happen with some authors. All of a sudden, this character.
It's the UPS guy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, come on, I want to know as the book's going along who it is. I want to know. I mean, if the killer's there, I want to know that he's there, and I want to figure it out for myself.
It's funny as I'm talking to people while they're reading a book, because I never tell until they finish it. But they're still coming to me going, I think I know who it is, but I'm not 100% sure. Then the next time you see it, they're like, I think it wasn't that, but it's this one I know. I've got it.
Well, let's talk about the question, A Question of Honor, the new one. Did you know when you started writing this book who the killer was right away, or
it came out as a story again.
It comes out of the story.
When we first started, we thought he was definitely guilty. And I'm not giving anything away, but we were fairly sure where we were going. And then as we explored the subject matter, I use that as a euphemism for the plot.
Mm-hmm.
We began to see all the things that could possibly have happened. And as you work with this, you begin to cast doubts on your original idea, and you begin to see that there is a potential for something else to have happened that you hadn't thought of. It might be the same killer, but there might be an extraordinarily different approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
Our first chapter is usually fairly short, if you haven't noticed.
Yeah.
But, in several of the Rutledge books and in the Murder Stone, I think the first chapter in the Murder Stone is like 2.5 pages.
No, it's a one page.
It's a one page,
When they printed it.
You're right, chapter one is like 4 pages.
I have to convert my brain from manuscript to printed page, but the story starts there. That's where we collaborate face to face the most. I'm not saying as it goes through we fully collaborate with each other, but the most intense work is setting the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Setting the stage. And if we can get that right, everything just flows from that. I mean, it's really amazing. And as you get to know your characters and see their depths and understand their frustrations or their worries or their fears. For example, in one of the books, there was a very strong possibility that a certain person had done the killing. And neither of us wanted that person to be the murderer.
Hmm.
It wasn't something that we could be happy with, and yet the closer we came to the ending, the more likely it was that this person was guilty. And so it superseded what we as authors.
I've always
really
loved mysteries like that, where you actually get to the end of a book sometimes and you're not sure if the villain is a hero villain or just the villain.
Right, exactly.
There was a particular episode of Columbo, the only one where he didn't take in the criminal because she had a brain and she wasn't going to live for very long. She was starting to lose it, and he had admired her as a old actress of the stage and screen, so he kind of postponed it, and it felt right. You knew that he had solved the crime, but somebody kind of stood up in a gentlemanly manner and it phased through without him actually putting the person in chains. And I always thought that was one of their neatest endings.
Now, here's an interesting question. If somebody picks up, if they pick up A Question of Honor, how early, if they're really, really good detectives, how early can they figure out the ending, do you think?
I don't know, because we don't know.
But at the same time, you leave clues along the way, though.
You do, but it's a very interesting thing. You'll be writing, and just to use an off the top of my head example, you see a butterfly, and you, Rutledge or Bess, will say something, make a remark about a butterfly on the bush. And then 30 pages, 50 pages, 100 pages later, you think, oh my gosh, that butterfly was the answer. And you're just amazed. The clue is there, but your subconscious has put it in there.
Mm.
Or it recognizes it later as a possible clue.
Well, they, you know, and sometimes writers will throw a little thing in, and you're like, oh, what does that have to do with the plot? And you'll suddenly realize, oh, that's going to come into play at the end of the book somehow.
Well, yeah. You have your different red herrings and everything else, but, you know, I don't think either one of us really... We've read so many mysteries, that's what we use as a guide more than a lot of these, you know, the Ten Commandments of mystery writing or whatever that say you must have this red herring, or red herring has to be like this or that or the other, because, as Caroline's been saying, it's the characters themselves that are driving the mystery. And I've had people come up and tell me, I think it's so-and-so, and they've picked the right person. But I don't say anything, because 9 times out of 10, it's not till they get to the end of the book that they're fully satisfied that, yes, indeed, it was that person.
Right. So they don't see it. I mean, I've had people in my book groups will say, well, I knew who it was on page 30. And I'm thinking, what? How could you have known that early? And somehow they just know, just from reading books over and over and over again, they're able to determine who the killer is. I don't know how they do it, but...
Well, yeah, I'd hate to see what their batting average looks like.
I should let them read one of your books and tell me what page they knew the answer on. I mean, it's
you know, there's also the self-fulfilling prophecy, but I have had people who, you know... 5-6 chapters in of say, oh, it's this person, and I'll just, you know, whatever. I make no comment till they get to the end, and they will always say to me, you know, I thought it was that person, but then so-and-so happened, and I wasn't so sure anymore.
Right.
One of the things that really makes a good mystery is the ability, I think, of the writer to anticipate what the reader is going to need or to perceive as they go through. And if you read the real masters of mystery out there, you'll see that this is true. They don't consciously do this, I don't think, but they always have in the back of their mind the concept that the reader has to be able to follow this. The reader has to be able to understand this. You can't be obscure. You can't be off in your own world and hope that the reader comes with you.
That's what I like about your books, because the best ones especially, they get more and more interesting as they go along. And you're reading the book and you're just getting more and more into the story. And the Rutledge is the same way. I mean, there's just a point where they're unputdownable. They're you can't stop reading it.
And well, that happens to us. We'll be working along at 1, 2, 3 a.m. because the scene is going so well.
Right.
And you're just hot. You know, you know how this is going and what people are going to say. And the funny thing is that you cannot put that down and pick that up again the next day. You have to stay with the heat of the moment and realize.
Even if it's 3 in the morning?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Really?
My husband, John, Charles's father, sometimes would come into the kitchen at 3 o'clock in the morning when we were talking on the telephone and saying, could you keep it down? I'm trying to sleep. But the more we talked about it, the more excited we got.
Right.
Or we were arguing about some aspect. And it's really the thrill of that.
I mean, you're in the moment. You're in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well put.
It's like when
I think when Caroline's talking about arguments, this is one of the things that I would say would be the most different is Caroline will kind of veer off to the right, so to speak, and I'm saying to myself, no, I really, you know, I think you've made a wrong turn here, but sometimes it's learning the ability to just shut your mouth and give it a little time because both of us are willing to back up.
Mm-hmm.
If it heads to a certain point and there's a problem or a breakdown, we will back up and start again. But it's to have enough faith in the other person to say, all right, that's not what I would have done in this particular case, but let's see how it proceeds, and sometimes it'll actually be a roundabout way of accomplishing the same thing, and a lot of times it's done better. So,
whenever we get into a real conflict, the answer always is, what's best for Rutledge? What's best for Beth?
Mm-hmm.
What would they want? What would they need?
Right.
What has to fit into their world?
It's almost like they're in the room with you.
I dream about Rutledge and Beth when
I'm... Do you really?
Yeah. It's just... the next morning, there's not much I can do with it in terms of putting it on the page, but I do.
I think they could do a great job. The BBC could do a great job with Rutledge if they made the series. I can't imagine they couldn't come up... They couldn't really do a great...
No, you have to be very careful because...
I can't believe there hasn't been one yet. I mean,
We've had feelers, but one of the things that we're very insistent upon is that we keep control of the characters.
Control of the characters and control of the series, because somebody may come to you and say, well, I want Search the Dark.
Yeah.
Well, if they option that, that doesn't mean they do anything with it. It just means they sit on the rights
exactly.
for that book for X amount of time. And if we were to make a sale like that, the two critical things would be the characters and the buying the series as a whole, so that... Because once you break it up, you're going to have problems no matter what you do.
Well, what's the age of Beth, by the way? What is her age in this book, Question of Honor? Do you know?
Well, she's in her early 20s.
And how old is Rutledge at this point?
Late 20s. You figure he had a career at Scotland Yard,
mm-hmm.
and then went to war for 4 years, and then came back.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, he's probably 28.
He's knocking on 30 pretty hard.
It's funny because you don't talk about age in the books very much. I mean,
no, because that's deadly. You know, if we keep writing 40 more books, we don't have to worry about it.
I mean, Ian Rankin, I think he didn't Rebus
he
retire.
Out there.
And now he's coming back again. It's like people miss him too much. I mean,
yeah, and you think of Sherlock Holmes and the Falls. Conan Doyle killed him off and then had to bring him back. But the main thing is with selling your book to someone. We've talked to authors who have. They may say, well, okay, we want to go beyond the series and do this, this, and this. Now, it worked out very well for Colin Dexter with Endeavor and with Lewis and Hathaway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Beautifully. But you think about Elizabeth George, where they changed the characters quite a bit and then wrote stories that really weren't... I mean, when her character, one of her characters died, they just glossed over that.
Well, if you guys... If they should ever come to you and say, we want to do these, and the deal's made, would you know when you saw the actor if it was a good Rutledge?
Yeah.
You'd know right away?
Yeah, I mean, one of the people that is people are talking about right now is David Tarrant, who was a Doctor Who, and he's in the Broadchurch series.
Mm-hmm.
He's a phenomenal actor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The odd thing that I always say is I never figured on David Suchet as Poirot, and I never figured on, who did Sherlock?
Jeremy Brett.
If you had told me prior to seeing the actual shows that those were the two people you were considering for those roles, I would have told you were nuts.
Right.
Jeremy
Brett scared me.
Yeah.
He's a frightening Sherlock Holmes. I mean,
he really is, and yet David Suchet is. You know, I do agree that others did the proper accent and this and that and the other, but the minute you set eyes on David Suchet as Poirot, he just walked right off the page.
That's an amazing, yeah, you're right. It's an absolute transformation.
If you look at Jeremy Brett, I've seen some of the things he had done before he did Sherlock Holmes. For example, he was in My Fair Lady. He was a lovesick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a guy who was courting Liza. And he was in, was it one of the Sheridan plays? I can't remember now, but he had been in other things. And
wasn't he in Moonstone?
No, I think that was Stuart Granger.
Stuart Granger, there's
Moonstone,
a name right there.
It was a Masterpiece Theater production.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about Wilkie Collins. I can't remember whether he was in that or not. But
you know, the thing about David Suchet is I saw him in another movie. It was a bank heist movie. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, yeah.
He's played an airplane terrorist.
And I watched that whole movie. I didn't even know it was him. That's how good he was.
That's right.
He plays, I think it's Passenger 57 or one of those, you know,
with Harrison
Ford. High drama play.
Oh, was this the one with Wesley Snipes? I think Wesley
no,
Snipes.
No, that
yeah, I think it was. It's where he played an Arab hijacker.
Right.
He was the head.
He just disappears in his roles. I mean, you actually believe that he's that character.
Yeah, he had totally different way of speaking, of acting. I got halfway through that movie and I looked again and I said, wait a minute, and I went to Google, you know.
It's amazing. It's just amazing what he can do. I mean,
when you see English actors disappear into their roles, it really, really is astonishing. I mean, Judy Dench, I would never have chosen for M in the James Bond series, and yet she was a superb M.
Oh yeah, she's wonderful. She's so crotchety, and you know, you never know what she's.
That's weird because I would have picked Judy Dench in a heartbeat.
You would have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought she was perfect for that role.
I love when she gets angry. When she gets angry, I get excited. I don't know what it is.
Her eyes spark.
I know it's so much fun to watch her. I mean, I don't know if they've talked about retiring her. I think they did. She die in the last one. I can't remember.
I don't want to say for people who.
Yeah.
Haven't seen
oh well, I may have just spoiled something for somebody. You know.
But it was very interesting when I was in York about a week ago, week and a half ago. We went down to take one of the boat rides along the rivers in York. And the walk down to the boats was the Dame Judy Dench Lane. And, you know, it was a very strange feeling seeing this as you were going down. I took a picture of it. I'll have to get it out and use it on Facebook. But
the thing with Rutledge, I'm obsessed with Rutledge. I mean, I just love that series. Absolutely love it. But I think to myself, well, how much more can Rutledge take? I mean, how much more can his mind take before it's overload? Isn't that a concern of you guys?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and from our perspective, I think we've pushed him pretty close a couple of times.
I mean,
the most interesting thing is that people with PTSD don't have an out. I met someone when I was a child who had PTSD from shell shock from World War One, and he must have been in his 50s or 60s, I don't know. And there was no cure. There is a way to cope.
Other than alcohol, yeah.
And Butlich has been striving for that. But you don't decide one day that, well, we've gotten all we can get out of this. We'll just stop it. That's unfair to the people who are actually going through it.
Right.
And so Rutledge is learning slowly but surely a coping mechanism. In this next book, he has a lot of trouble with Hamish. But some books he doesn't, because the subject matter isn't close enough to the war to make Hamish appear as often as he does in some other books.
I'm thinking of the parallels now between Rutledge and Hamish and Dexter and his father. I don't know if you've ever seen Dexter, the TV show.
Yeah.
The way his father always talks to him, like, don't do that. You shouldn't do that. It's going to really mess you up. You know, it's the same kind of thing where somebody's at his beck and somebody's telling him to do something, and it's interesting the way they do that.
Hamish can only know what Rutledge knows. He's not an individual. He's not a ghost.
Right.
But he inhabits a level of Rutledge's mind where he picks up on a lot of the...
He has influence, too.
Yeah, he has influence because Rutledge respected him in life and feared him in death. And this is a very ambivalent kind of relationship.
Well, we're just about out of time almost. It's so much fun to talk to you guys.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Tell me what the next Best Crawford's going to be called. Do you have a title yet for it?
No, we haven't a title, but...
No title, but we know the new Rutledge is Hunting Shadows, I think.
That's Hunting Shadows, and the new Best starts out with a very interesting premise that we want to explore, and we'll see if it works.
You said you saw the new cover to Hunting Shadows.
Yes, I love it. With the gaslights, I love that.
Oh, isn't that something?
That's a real... I wish Danielle would send me the copy so I could read it, but I haven't gotten it in the mail yet. I keep checking my mailbox, but we'll see.
Have you... I know it's going to come out at VoucherCon.
Oh, really?
For a select few.
Oh.
We're going to sign about 25 copies.
Wow. How did they decide who the 20...
VoucherCon.
Yes, how do they decide who the 25 people are lucky enough to get it? That's the question.
First in line.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we'll do a special signing at VoucherCon, and the first 25 people will get.
Now, is that New York this year or some?
That's in Albany.
It's in Albany, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're very pleased with that. It's a fascinating story again.
How much did you say it was worth to you?
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the green, you know, whatever.
Well, I will certainly remind Danielle to send you a copy when they come out.
God, I just love to sit. You know what? You know how much joy I get out of just sitting and reading a Rutledge and trying to figure out the mystery? I mean, you'll never know how much joy I get out of that. Maybe you will now.
Good to know.
And I know everybody else is. I know everybody's going to enjoy A Question of Honor.
That's something we're excited about. If people read them, we'll write them.
Well, look, and you have a blurb from Stephen King. I didn't know that.
He didn't give us a blurb. He wrote that in an article in Entertainment Weekly.
Did he really?
All on his own.
Well, that's sort of like a blurb, isn't it?
I believe it's a monthly or a weekly... I think it's monthly or quarterly that he does a thing on mysteries in
Entertainment
Weekly.
And he mentioned you guys. How exciting.
Yep, that's his quote.
He's a fan? Have you heard from him?
No.
He was, you know, I'm involved with Mystery Writers of America, and he was our grandmaster, I think. Anyway, attended the event. Caroline, you saw him.
Yeah, Ali Cogdell interviewed him. But, you know, there were so many people around, we didn't have a chance to speak to him privately.
Oh, man.
But that really astonished me, because there are so many people who are fans, who, you know, we never every once in a while somebody will say something. Lee Child is a fan. We're a fan of his.
Wow.
But he's a fan of Rutledge's. Ian Rankin was reading Rutledge early on. I met him in Baltimore.
The only guy I know who shows up to a bar in a white T-shirt and a kilt.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we do have to say goodbye, I guess, but I hate to do it.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
You guys
and
are like...
we'll be back in touch, I hope, with the next Rutledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I hate to say goodbye. You guys are like friends. You're like family to me.
Absolutely. And it's been a long and good friendship.
It has. And the new book again is called Question of Honor. It's out from William Morrow and all your bookstores and hardcover and ebook and all that. And I'm sure there's an audio of it, right? Is there an audio of it?
I think there's going to be, yes.
There will be.
Oh, wonderful. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.